Hello and welcome everybody, rowers around the world. It's rowing chat time again this month. I'm Rebecca Caro, and of course we've got a guest with us this week. Hello, who are you and what do you do?
Hello, good evening from the UK. My name is Jim Flood. I'm a coach at my local rowing club, which is Reading Rowing Club in the UK, just west of London. And I'm also a coach educator for British Rowing, which means I run courses for the UK qualifications. And also I'm a development coach for FISA. So I do work in different countries teaching on the FISA coaching courses and also working with rowing federations to grow rowing as a sport.
Fantastic. Jim, you and I met quite a few years ago, didn't we?
We did, yes, Rebecca. I remember it well.
We did a seminar together, and the reason you intrigued me was you were the first person I'd met who had this interest in teaching coaches, not just in coaching yourself. And I think it is a particular sub-niche of the sort of coaching mindset, that there's this educational overlay. How did you get interested in it?
Oh, well, let's start with the history. I started off quite young as a swimming coach. And I then took up rowing at about the age of 18, 19 at university. And because I already had a background in coaching, very soon I progressed through rowing and also coaching some of the beginners. I had a long break after a successful 3 years at university. I followed the career trail, came back to rowing when I was about 40, started competing and then started coaching again and started taking my coaching qualifications. And in the meantime, I'd also coached soccer and rugby. So coaching was something I was interested in, but also I've been in the educational field for most of my life. So that aspect of teaching, learning, coaching is something which has always fascinated me.
And when you coached all these different sports, did you get a chance to compare how each sport educated its coaches, or did you just teach yourself and figure it out as you went along?
I did a swimming coaching qualification. Not that I remember much of it, but what struck me was that the coaching was very didactic. It was the process was, I'm the coach, I talk, you listen, I say, you do. Mm-hmm. That was a bit similar in soccer and rugby mm-hmm. at the time. And when I started coaching rowing, I started experimenting a bit, really drawing on some of my interest in teaching and learning, how people learn. Started quite early on, particularly with the teaching of diving, which is all about confidence.
Yes.
And I experimented with ways of giving people confidence to take risks, and that got me interested in how people learn, not just the academic facts and figures, which is much, you know, a large part of our education, but how people learn skills and how they learn to control their own bodies and to a certain extent their minds as well. This sort of link between the mind and the body and getting them to do things which are more efficient, more comfortable, more effective.
And what do you call that style of coaching if didactic was the I speak, you do style?
British Rowing calls it participant-focused rowing, although they're also using the term rower-focused coaching. So it's based on the idea that it's not just a one-way communication system, it's a two-way communication system. But the important person is the person being coached, the participant. Mm-hmm. And there's a very, very nice rowing video on US rowing, on common faults and how to improve them. Incidentally, I'm a big fan of some of the coaching videos on US rowing. But there's an American coach, very experienced American coach, talking, and he says, it took me years and years to realize that when I was talking to these athletes, they were trying their hardest. And if they weren't succeeding, it wasn't because they weren't trying, it's because I wasn't succeeding in explaining, showing, demonstrating, giving them drills which would facilitate that understanding. So it's the idea that if the athletes are not doing what you want them to do, it's not their fault, it's you as the coach, it's your fault.
And is this something that has developed across a range of different sports, or is it something that you found and have pushed in rowing?
I'm not sure about other countries, but certainly in the UK, and I would assume it's fairly worldwide. I'm very impressed with the coaching materials for both tennis and football. The Football Association site in the UK has some wonderful examples of participant-focused coaching, and also setting the athletes problems to solve for themselves, to work out. Because one way we learn is actually by teaching ourselves. So let me just, and because of that, I no longer explain to people who are just starting to in a sculling boat for the first time. I don't explain how to make the boat go backwards, which I did at one time. I now say to them, how do you think you could make the boat go backwards? And let them work it out for themselves. Mm-hmm. Obviously, avoiding any gross mistakes. But first of all, they often do it quicker than they discover it quicker than they would by me explaining. And they learn it more effectively. They're making the connections, between the brain and the muscle movement much more effectively.
Very, very interesting. And in taking this message about participant-focused coaching out to all the people you bump into in your rowing life, how has it been received?
Not very well. is the short answer. Because there is evidence from some large-scale research that one of the greatest influences on the way a teacher teaches is not their teacher training or their teacher education, but the way they were taught. And I suspect that the biggest influence on coaches is the way they were coached. And of course, most coaches, say above the age of 40, would have experienced very didactic coaching. So I think there's quite a deeply ingrained procedure. And of course, actually, there are some incredibly didactic coaches who are incredibly successful.
Yes. Any suggestions on how to work around this or overcome it, if it genuinely is a better and quicker way of teaching people to acquire the rowing and sculling skills?
I think to get them to be adventurous and to give it a try. And to make, encourage them to make the learners complicit in the learning process, to discuss with them what's working, what's not working, how could it be better. And that's quite risky for many coaches. They don't feel comfortable with doing it. But once they try it, I think they begin to see that it has considerable benefits.
I know that that can work at a range of different experience levels. It's not just for people who teach beginners. A few years ago, I was fortunate enough to interview on Rowing Chats Duncan Holland, who coached at Cambridge University for boat race. And he had a group of athletes who came from different countries around the world. And he explained that particularly the North American athletes were very uncomfortable with being able to discuss their point of view with the coach. He said the Europeans, particularly the Germans, reveled in the opportunity to be listened to and to have their points of view heard so that they contributed to the overall objective of learning and acquiring skill and building a crew, whereas the Americans found it incredibly different from what they had experienced when they were being coached in North America.
That's fascinating. I wasn't aware of that, but your question was what sort of reaction do I find? And coaching in Africa, it's quite a difficult concept, and I don't even try too hard with it because the teaching in the schools is incredibly didactic, whether it's a hangover from colonial days or whether it's an aspect of the culture. The coach also has authority. There is a sort of a hierarchy there. And the idea that the coach should even discuss procedures with the athletes would be seen to be a sign of weakness, lack of authority, or indecisiveness. They have to be certain, sure, and very directive.
Very interesting indeed. So moving on, what do you think is the state of coach education for rowing coaches in the world today?
I can only talk about the countries I know. I think it would correlate well with the gold medals being won, the medals being won. So you've got Canada, America, Australia, European countries and the UK, mainly Northern European countries. They're the ones with the coaching structures and also talent identification programs and also the money as well. So once we start going beyond that, what I see is, for example, in South America, they don't have a structure of coach education. They're beginning now to develop one, and they're using some of the FISA coaching materials, which incidentally are very good, and they're available free for download on the FISA website. The African countries are just starting to develop rowing and coach education, and that's at a very early stage. So apart from using the FISA courses, which are not really well adapted to their needs in some cases, so they need to develop their own coach education within the country so it fits comfortably with their resources and their culture and their facilities and what they can simply afford in terms of coach education.
So you come in as an assistant with FISA to a country, doesn't really matter where. What do you actually do in terms of helping out with this FISA coach development program?
Well, it varies. In South America, I was working with the National Federation to look at developing a structure of coach education, because they're well down the line. They Argentina, for example, often has athletes in Olympic finals. In Africa, it's very different. Usually, I go in at the point at which they will have received a container of boats, shipping container with six basic singles, four doubles, and two coastal type fours. That's the standard sort of package with trestles and blades. So, for example, 5 years ago, I went out to Uganda and I was there when we opened the container, took the boats out, put them together, and were putting them on the water for the first time. And it was basically teaching rowing and identifying people who had the potential to be coaches and giving them some very basic strategies for coaching and running the activity safely in terms of the participants and safe management of the equipment.
You sent us a lovely photograph of some people clearly on a very early, if not their first outing, wearing life jackets, I think.
I that's quite recent, actually, because that's an adaptive group in Uganda, rowing on Lake Victoria. So the adaptive rowers do wear life jackets or buoyancy aids there, yeah. And it's interesting that adaptive rowing is growing quite slowly, I think, in the UK and other countries, but it's developing at a very similar rate to able-bodied rowing, certainly in Uganda and Kenya. There's great interest in it because generally other sports have not taken a lead in developing adaptive athletes.
That doesn't surprise me. Moving on to a slightly different question. Do you have a gearing formula that you use using ERG scores, strength and ability for different athletes? This is for gearing boats.
Are we talking about Row Perfect here?
No. Whichever, I don't mind.
Sorry, Rebecca, I couldn't resist that one. Well, I use the standard material, which is available on the Concept 2 website. I've got my Bible alongside me, which is Rowing Faster by Volker Nolte, which has got most of the information in that I need. So I'm not sure what the question is in terms of gearing. I would assume it's using a standard drag factor, which generally would be about 130 for male athletes, perhaps a little bit lighter for females and juniors. And then I would be again using the looking at what I wanted to measure. So if I was measuring just straightforward muscle power, then I rather like the 10-stroke test. So you give the athlete a chance to warm up, and then over 30 strokes, you give them the opportunity to row, to drive as hard as they can to achieve the maximum score over 10 strokes. And that's going to give you a measure of raw power. Measuring aerobic capacity, you want about a 6K test. Aerobic power, 2K test. Anaerobic capacity, 60-second test. And aerobic endurance, about a 60-minute test. So, I mean, I'm lifting this straight out of textbooks, really, because most of this results from research, and I'm quite happy to draw on experts and not try and make it up myself.
When you take that knowledge of what your athletes have scored on the ERG, how do you take that then into gearing on a boat?
First of all, can I just deal with the question of what I would do with the information? Because I would be looking, using that as a test, say a monthly test, I would be looking for improvements. And I might even set some benchmark improvements for them. Now, let's say that their muscle power, that 10 stroke pull test, wasn't improving. Then I might shift the balance towards weight training. If they weren't doing well on the 60-second test, or they weren't showing a standard progression, through that, I would actually work a bit more on the anaerobic capacity. So I'd build that more anaerobic work into their training. I'd shift the balance. So this would be a test, and then I would use the indicators It's a test I would repeat. I'd be looking for an even progression. And if there wasn't an even progression, I would shift the balance of the training in order to get a weakness in muscle power up. When it comes to gearing in the boat, again, I use pretty standard measurements. The only thing I would say is that in my experience, not enough coaches change the span. They will change the gearing from the by moving the button, the inboard and the outboard on the blades, when in my view they should do a bit more experiments on reducing the span, because first of all that will increase the stroke length, and often rowers will feel they'll feel as though they've got a higher load. And that's because they're getting a more effective catch and able to get more work on.
Interesting. So what are the circumstances that you would then recommend that to a coach?
I think I'd recommend it in almost any situation as an experiment, unless, first of all, I'd want to measure the sweep angle as accurately as I could, even if it's taking photographs from a bridge as they come underneath. Although there's a fascinating YouTube of someone using one of these small drone helicopters with a camera on board, flying above a boat. Let's say it's on YouTube. I'll perhaps send a link that people can have a look at it, because it strikes me that that's a wonderful tool. So back to the question. If I've got an elite crew, and they're getting a sweep angle of, 85 degrees, and then I'm pretty sure that the rigging's okay.
So 85 degrees is from catch to finish.
Yeah. We can discuss the finer points of that, but I'm looking for total sweep angle. Given that some top athletes will be getting on for 90 degrees, and certainly 90 degrees in sculling is not unusual. Sweep, a little bit less, but... there are some veteran rowers who can actually sweep sort of 85 degrees plus. So it's stroke length that I would be looking for. And that's where I'd want to start by measuring that. And if, as is often the case, even with good standard club rowers, they've only got a sweep angle of 75 degrees. So the first thing I'd do is actually reduce the span so that they start getting the feel of what it's like, and at the same time working on their flexibility and working on their posture so they can get the proper reach.
And the measurements are, as you say, you take them by taking photographs and then printing the photographs and using a protractor and a compass to measure the angle.
Yes, because there are some very good software now, and the names jumped out of my head, Rebecca, before you ask, but we'll put it up on the website. It's free video editing software that you can draw the lines on the video.
There's an app I know called Coach's Eye.
I know Coach's Eye, and there is another one. Coach's Eye, you have to pay for. The other one is free. I'll see if I can bring it up. One is a gap question. So yes, it's a question of measuring that angle. Mm-hmm. Incidentally, there are very fancy bits of hardware and software now that you can attach to the rigger, and you get a complete readout of the sweep angles and the force at the pin, etc., etc.
Yes, it's getting more and more technical at some parts of the sport, isn't it?
Oh, it is, but we're looking for nearly all the top regattas now, the finishes are so fine, we're talking about getting, you know, 0.001% improvement. You know, it's going to win a race.
Yeah. Moving on to a question that's come through from Santiago in Chile. How do you commit people to supporting rowing institutions at their early stages of development? And by this, I take it to mean perhaps a new club that's starting out, or perhaps a new group within a club. Maybe you're starting a master's group or a junior's group.
Well, first of all, I know another person who's put the question, actually, because I've done some work in Chile with a group who are building up rowing from scratch, and they're very interested in how to do it. And I think they're doing a great job. Okay. I think it's a vital question, because so many clubs in the UK are running learn to row courses. And generally, the learn to row courses attract a lot of people. They have a nice time. Some of them decide that rowing's not for them. It's been very nice, thank you, but I don't want to actually pay club membership because I've had a nice time, but it's not really for me. It's been a nice taster. But a significant proportion then join the club. And it's that gap between the learn to row course and the getting into a squad boat and training with a crew where, in many cases, I feel we haven't got right. So I'd be interested in your comments on this, but I think there are three key factors. One is that there are clear paths communicated to the rowers. So coming off a learn to row course, there should be a clear progression through to the squads, a clear progression through to recreational rowing, or a clear progression into rowing as an individual in your own time with your own group, sort of a particular independent rowing, let's call it.
Self-directed, yes.
And that stage, I think, is quite critical, because I see in that phase some participants responding well to the didactic shouting, you know, get used to this is what it's going to be like, so you might as well get used to it, do the circuit training, get on an erg, be shouted at to work harder, come on, you can do it kind of approach. And that for some is great, for others it's very alienating, it's very disconcerting. So it is how to get some paths there which are comfortable for a range of people. My guess is that many clubs who take rowers off a learn to row course into the club probably lose about 70% of them in the first year. What's your experience of this, Rebecca?
Well, I was going to say that would be borne up by the recent data from Sport England when they appraised the post-Olympic legacy in rowing. And they do a telephone survey to find out across the country whether people are doing sport and whether they're doing more or less of it than they were a couple of years ago. And rowing, grassroots rowing, experienced a cut in its funding because they had not maintained participation numbers. So I will say, though, that I know that there were some issues with the research survey methodology, because apparently they refused to use mobile phone numbers. And as you know, nowadays, more people have mobile phone numbers than have landlines. And of course, particularly if you want to capture younger people, they're less likely to answer a landline and more likely to answer a mobile phone. But I would say that anecdotally, that would absolutely back up your experience, and certainly in my own club, where we do adult masters learn to row programs, we get, of every sort of three or four that come through, one or possibly two stick around and then actually want to participate. Now, I will say that my club does not offer very clearly self-directed rowing. although we do offer recreational rowing and competitive rowing for masters.
Yeah, thanks for that. So that's the first factor, the clear paths of progression which are supported. And the second factor is that support. Are they feeling as though they're getting teaching? Are they feeling as though they're getting the right resources, not having to hang around waiting for a boat, waiting for a crew, waiting for a coach? And then the third factor, I think, is the quality of coaching, because in terms of a hierarchy, the best rowers get the best coaches. And in my view, it should be the beginners getting the best coaches, and best coaches in terms of commitment, skill, enthusiasm, ability to communicate, to excite, to interest. So what I often see is someone doing the Learn to Row course or looking at the, you know, doing the Improvers course, who have very little experience themselves, and they're struggling, and they're not communicating a sense of confidence and purpose, and they're not getting the kind of progression that that good coaching would give these people. So those are the three factors, I think, which are important. And I think there's another one, if I can just add another one, and it's to get a culture within the club that is welcoming. I row with vets group, and as a vets group, we are not good about welcoming younger vets that come off Learn to Row courses. But the people we're interested in is the people who come from other clubs who are going to get in the boat and make it go faster. And I suspect from talking to other vets in other clubs that's a similar kind of problem. It's a bit exclusive. So I think we've got to become much more inclusive in terms of our attitude and welcoming of new people into rowing.
One of the things to respond to that last point that I have observed, when I was rowing at Tideway Scullers, we used to open up the bar and sell tea and coffee and toast in between outings on a Saturday and Sunday morning. And each squad group in the club had to take their turn staffing this. So it would rotate through the juniors, the senior athletes, men and women, and the veterans. And this had the most incredible, unexpected side benefit, which was to break down barriers between the groups. Because if you're standing behind the bar saying, hello, can I, you know, how many cups of tea and how many slices of toast do you want? You're obliged to actually have a face-to-face conversation with people who you do not normally speak to. And as a result, everybody got a lot more friendlier and a lot more welcoming. And people knew other people to speak to, even if it was just to say hello. And it was the most fantastic experiment in breaking down barriers.
I think that's a lovely example. Certainly, the people that come on Learn to Row courses, in my experience, or should I say a large percentage of the people who come on the Learn to Row courses, are looking for a social connection with a club as much as a sporting connection. They're looking to make friends. They're often young professional people who've moved into the area, or older people who are looking for a new interest. But the key element is actually meeting a group and socialising with them before, during and after rowing.
Absolutely support that. Now we're going to pause for a minute and have a word from our sponsors. Any aspiring rowing coach needs to read Steve Fairburn. His deep insights into the key movements that propel a boat forwards are timeless. Every coach can learn ways to improve his eye or his way of observing crews rowing by reading the words Steve Fairburn wrote about how to coach. Never mind that boats, materials and technologies have progressed. Fairburn was writing in the early 20th century. The simple fact of a human with an oar remains the same. You can become a better coach by studying his methods. And if you like a good yarn of David versus Goliath, you'll also love learning how Fairburn, the upstart Australian, faced down the English establishment, comprehensively beating their rowing crews with his own, who rowed to his technique, style, and trained with his methods. All Rowing Chat listeners will get an email offering a 30% discount on the Amazon Kindle edition of Steve Fairbairn's On Rowing. This will be emailed to you tomorrow if you're signed up on the Eventbrite for this Rowing Chat. Now, back to Jim Flood. Jim, what tips can you offer a coach on ways to improve their skills? If they've been intrigued by what you've been talking about this morning, what can they do to move themselves forward?
Oh, they've got to be alongside other coaches. They've got to be able to watch them, ideally with their permission and agreement. And, you know, sit in on coaching sessions. A good coach has got to be a thief. You've got to steal ideas. And, you know, most of the ideas that I teach, which people say, oh, that's really good, I've taken from other people. Now, I've adapted it to my own style and experience and wording. But it's actually getting a bank of ideas, and even watching a bad coach is still a useful experience, because you can say, okay, you know, bad in your judgment, that is, you can say, okay, that's not how I want to coach, and that's not the way I would do it. But thinking about the obverse, how would I do it? How would I have explained that? How would I have dealt with that problem? In too many clubs, coaches are insular. They don't even talk to each other. Never mind have meetings and discuss the deeper aspects of technique or methods of coaching. So for young coaches or older people, older rowers who've started coaching, watch other coaches and don't be afraid to steal their ideas. And read a lot of good stuff on video on YouTube now as well, in terms of coaches in action and coaching techniques.
And I was going to say, and if you have any questions and you want to send them in to Row Perfect, we will put them out to the community to answer. And there's a lot of questions we get from readers. Some are rowing related, some are coaching related. And mostly we get some fantastic answers to put back out there for other people to read and experience.
I couldn't agree more, Rebecca. Almost anything now, whether it's a fault on my computer, whether it's how to fix the freewheel on my bike, the first thing I do is go on the blogs, and I get the answers very quickly and very efficiently, and very good they are too. Same with rowing. And certainly I've picked up a lot from the blogs on the Row Perfect site.
Now, tell us more about FISA's objectives with its rowing development programme. Why do they have it, and what's it trying to achieve?
Well, at the basic level, it's to keep rowing in the Olympics, because all sports, Olympic sports, face pressure, because there are more sports going on than there are sports in the Olympics. And each year there are some additions, and if there are some additions, there are some sports going to be dropped. Now, the way that you keep your sport in the Olympics is by increasing participation. So the objective of FISA clearly has to be increased, to be able to increase participation in the sport, and particularly from countries that haven't previously engaged and competed at world championship and Olympic level. So that's the objective. Now, there are sort of the worthier objectives, the higher level of objectives. But that is a very strong driver.
That's pretty good, though. I mean, we all want to keep rowing in the Olympics, and so presumably there's no objection to anyone. There are people, though, who, of course, say the Olympics is the pinnacle of achievement, and why should we allow people like Eric the Eel in swimming, you know, to come and compete there when it's perfectly clear that they're going to get wiped out at the first heat and repechage?
Yes, and we've all seen, in particular at the World Championships, rowers from some of the North African countries coming in a minute behind the winners. But on the other hand, they are very aspirational. And, you know, it's a bit like when the Chinese started rowing. You know, they were well behind. But look at the Chinese now. So I think there will be very quick progression from these countries. Mainly because of the system of Olympic scholarships. If colleagues out there are not aware of it, the International Olympic Committee has an offshoot called Olympic Solidarity, and you can find it on their website. And amongst other things, they give scholarships to rowers from developing countries to train in either North America, Europe, even Australia, to bring them on at a very rapid pace. So there are lots of opportunities for rapid progression. There is also the route to the Olympics through the continental regattas. So for example, you get to the Olympics either by winning world championships or getting in the first up to 9 places in the world championships will qualify you. But then the other way is the continental regattas, which are the year before. So next year there will be the continental regattas. And it varies slightly, but generally the first 2 or 3 will then get an automatic place in the Olympics.
So what will be the future of world rowing, say, in 10 years?
Structurally, I would like, I'm just a foot soldier here in terms of FISA. I'm not involved with policy. What I would like to see is more training camps. Currently, they have training camps, FISA training camps around the world. I'd like to see more of them. Not more of them and offering more courses, because the exchange of ideas, bringing athletes and coaches together and having some top coaches there working with them is going to raise standards. And I hope that the money is going to be available. At the moment, there's a FISA camp regularly in Spain, in Sevilla, South Africa, I think Germany has one as well, and North America. So I would like to see more of them, and several times a year, and the funding for athletes and coaches to go to them. I would also like to see world rowing promote boat building and manufacture in the home countries. Because at the moment, for example, Uganda and Kenya and other countries have to import boats. Now, the boats for them are incredibly expensive to start with. They then pay 25% import duty, and then they pay 16% VAT on the total. And sometimes the container of boats gets stuck in customs for a long time because of arguments over the payment of the duty. For example, I'm going to Nigeria tomorrow, as it happens, because their container of boats has been released from customs after, would you believe it, 11 years?
Whoa! And that's because of a dispute on tax and import duty.
Exactly. Yeah, there are. The government can waive the tax in terms of aid, for example. So they don't pay duty on aid. But whether classifying rowing boats for sport as aid is a contentious issue. So, but it seems to me crazy economically for countries to be importing boats when they've got boat building skills, and that can stimulate the local economy, and they can make boats at an economic cost. For example, he's a very good boat builder in South America. Their boats are really very, very good because they've got a boat builder there. And that's really promoted the growth of the sport. We need that kind of development in Africa, to a lesser extent Asia, where you've got China with three very big boat builders now, but certainly other parts, say India, and that just about covers it, I think. But using locally built boats for basic training. And I would actually like to see what we used to call restricted regattas in this country. We used to have races in restricted boats, and we don't anymore.
And that aligns with committee boats, which interestingly was an article we wrote last month on the Row Perfect blog, where the regatta provides the boats.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely right. I've been to regattas in Buenos Aires, where they've had 500 participants, and they're all rowing wooden boats. Mm-hmm. And all the boats are supplied there. The kids just turn up and they have a ball. Absolutely fantastic.
Brilliant. So moving on to another little side project of yours, which is your Open Ergo Wiki. What inspired you to go and create this, Jim?
Well, it wasn't so much inspiration. Well, inspiration is partly need. But my background is as an engineer. I've been involved in the design of medical equipment, and I've worked with aid programs. I've done work for WaterAid on the pumps, things like that. So it was quite a natural progression to then look at the problem of rowing machines, which are needed to support the development of rowing, very expensive to import. They're often in conditions which are not conducive to a long life. For example, the boats are delivered in containers. Security is an issue, so often the ergs have to be taken apart each time they're used and locked up in a container. And that action of getting them in and out all the time tends to put a lot of strain on them. So again, I was looking for a design based on the principles of alternative technology, or appropriate technology as it's sometimes called, based on the idea of let's use local materials, local skills, to produce an artifact which we may used locally. So that's where the origin of the Open Ergo came. But there's another issue. We need to get people making Open Ergos in Europe and North America, because people in Africa are very aspirational. They don't want second best. If you ask them what kind of boats they want, they'll tell you they want the Felipes, the Empacas, the Hudsons. They know their stuff. But if we start using some very basic boats here, on the lines that you just outlined in terms of, you know, committee boat racing, restricted class racing, and they see us doing that, they'd be more inclined to be happy to use the basic boats, training boats that they've made themselves, and perhaps we can have ergo competitions using the very basic wooden type ergometers, and having competitions over the internet, using Skype, just focusing on a very simple bicycle type speedometer, which you can attach to a very basic erg and get a measurement of speed over time.
Very interesting. Moving on to a different question. If you're doing time trials, testing out different types of oars, fatigue in the athletes is a factor. How do you overcome this?
It's an interesting question, because I'm not quite sure why you'd be using different types of oars, or if you're making slightly different changes in the outboard and the inboard. So it's still a good question. And I would be saying, okay, let's take the group of athletes and let's try and find out over a series of tests. Let's say relatively short, say 500 meters, and let's run a series of tests, let's say six runs over 500 meters, where using the same blades, we're likely to be able to get an idea of the fatigue factor. So let's say on the first two runs, they're probably pretty close. Then they're going to be dropped down by 5 seconds, 10 seconds, 20 seconds. So you'll get an idea of what the fatigue factor is with those particular athletes. So when you start making changes to either the rigging or the oars, you can then build that fatigue factor into the tests. Does that make sense?
That makes perfect sense. That's great advice. Our last question comes in from Elizabeth in Rochester in New York, who's a very loyal listener of Rowing Chat. And she asks, some rowers tip their chin up and their head back just as they apply power in the drive, and then they hold it there through to the finish. Can you offer an effective explanation for this that will help a rower keep their chin down?
Well, I hope so. And I want to preface my response by saying that to me, and it loops back to the almost the first question about participant-focused coaching, I believe that athletes need to understand and they need to know the answer to three questions. In education terms, it's what is it you're going to learn? How are you going to learn it? Why are you learning it? So in answer to Elizabeth's question, it's being able to explain to the athlete what it is they're doing, why they're doing it, and how they're doing it. And generally, that tipping the head back is a result of heaving with the shoulders. So they're throwing their head back because the effort is going in the shoulders and not the legs. And it's almost as if throwing their head back is like throwing this heavy object back, which gives some momentum to the shoulders. Now, how to prevent it? Well, there are lots of very good exercises. And I think, Elizabeth, yeah, if you have gone on the US Rowing website, there's a video on using the ergometer to coach rowing. And there's some very good exercises there on getting the athlete to push with the legs and keep the body posture in that forward leaning position until the legs are nearly down. Now, what the athlete needs to understand is they're going to get more power. They're going to be more effective if they get a better leg drive. They keep that forward lean and they don't throw their head back. And there are various ways you can actually demonstrate that on the ergometer. And that video, which I've just mentioned, demonstrates that extremely well.
Fabulous. Well, we'll find that video and we'll include it in the post-event email to all attendees. So hopefully we'll all benefit from seeing those particular sets of videos. I've got a last question, which is back to coaches educating themselves to improve. If I'm a rowing coach and I'm interested in some of the ideas and the concepts you've been discussing today, Jim, how can I start experimenting as a coach?
Small steps. Try just one or two things, depending on where you're at. Particularly listening to the athletes, asking them how things feel when there are changes made to the boat, getting their views on it, starting to have a discussion with them. That's one aspect. But the other aspect of improving is this idea of continuing professional development and self-reflection, because one of the aspects of the British Rowing Level 2 course is self-reflection. And that is something which many people find very difficult. It's common in nearly all professions. My daughter's a physio and she hates this idea of self-reflection, which she has to do each year, and I have to help her with it. So the idea of thinking, okay, what am I doing? How am I doing it? How could I do it better? And looking at some sessions that you've done and saying, what did I do which worked? What did I do which wasn't quite as good? What might I do next time? Now, in courses, you have to write that down, and that's going to be the painful bit. But if you're thinking about it and rehearsing it in your mind. I think that's a good way to improve. So small steps in making changes, don't change overnight. Try something, you know, try the idea of, if teaching some sculling, of saying, okay, instead of teaching them step by step how to row backwards, how to back down, asking them to try and work it out for themselves, or how to turn the boat round themselves. So try some experiments, see if it works for you. Small steps. Watch other coaches, read, but think, reflect.
There's a very interesting coxing website written by a lady called Kayleigh Derm, which is called Ready All Row, and she advocates coxswains recording themselves during an outing and publishing it privately to their crew after every single outing. Not only do they have the opportunity to hear what they actually said and perhaps do this reflection afterwards, it also allows the crew then to give feedback about the calls that they thought were effective.
That's such a good example. One of my heroes, who I hope you're going to have on Rowing Chat, is Thomas Poulsen. Until very recently, the Danish national coach, a lightweight gold medal winner himself, and in terms of success, you know, 7 gold medals at the last Olympics with a population of 5.6 million people, less than the size of Manchester, that's Denmark, and athletes, which are all amateurs, they're either in full-time work or they're students, and I've talked to Thomas and asked him how he manages this, and he says, well, firstly, I get to know. My first job is to get to know my rowers. I get to know what they do, how they think. And I listen to them. I spend a lot of time listening to them. And that, to me, was something that's caused me to reflect very deeply on how I interact with the athletes I coach.
Very interesting. Now, Jim, just before we finally wrap up, you've offered a prize for our listeners at the end of the month. Do you want to tell everyone about it?
Well, I think it's two prizes, actually. It's two T-shirts from Argentina. One is a very nice sort of Lycra tight fit, one which was used by the national team about 3 years ago. And the other one is more of an open neck style, which is also got Argentina on the back, and the kind of thing you can strut around your club in, looking cool. And that's it's a shirt from the Argentinian National Olympic Committee. So two T-shirts up for grabs.
Fantastic. Thank you very much. Now, Jim, would you like to let listeners know where they can get hold of you online?
They can indeed. It's my email address is jimflood42@gmail.com. So it's jimflood42@gmail.com. And I do welcome a dialogue. As I've said, I'm off to Nigeria tomorrow, so I'm going to be probably out of email contact for about the next 10 days. But generally, I do try and respond to people and engage with them over issues that interest them and interest me.
Fantastic. Jim, you've been a marvellous guest, and I've really enjoyed hearing and learning more from you about all the aspects of rowing that intrigue us both. Thank you very much.
It's been a pleasure, Rebecca. Many thanks for inviting me.